Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Wednesday, May 19th. And joining us in the room today are our colleagues from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Welcome to those members. Senator Burdick, would you like to introduce the members of your committee before we do our roll call for House?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we have from the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee today, we have Senator Wagner, Senator Boquist, Senator Riley, and on the phone we have Senator Finley.
Thank you so much. Welcome, Senators. Could we have a roll call for attendance for the House Revenue Committee?
Representative Levy.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, I'm here.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Smith is excused, but he will be joining us in just a moment.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Reschke present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video. Thank you everyone for being here promptly. Mr. Alanak, would you please begin by introducing what this topic is? I am now opening the informational meeting for the economic and revenue forecast. And will you also explain to the members and the public where to find information that will be presented to us?
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of both committees. Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So in OLIT, today you will hear the presentation of the May forecast. And as usual, it's Mark McMullen and Josh Lehner from the Office of Economic Analysis who will be making the presentation. And for people watching through OLIS or accessing information on OLIS, if you go to the House Committee on Revenue for today's meeting and click on Meeting Materials, you will find a copy of OEA's presentation and a forecast summary from LRO, and then a third document on other funds revenue that I was going to mention at the end of the meeting. So with that, that's who will be doing the presentation.
Great. We're ready to hear from the Office of Economic Analysis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Nathanson, Chair Burdick. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen. I serve as Oregon State Economist, and I'm joined, as always, by my colleague, Josh Lehner. So for this quarterly economic forecast, I guess right off the bat, I guess we should just go ahead and not bury the lead and give the bottom line is that this outlook, there is a whole lot more resources available than we last reported in March, and even more than we reported at the beginning of the session when the budget was drafted 2 years ago. In fact, we're looking at more than $1 billion of additional resources, both in the not only in the current biennium, but in the next three to come. And so That's quite a remarkable turnaround from a few months ago when the COVID pandemic hit. We saw these massive job losses and went ahead and blew a $2 billion hole in the budget. That hole was filled by the March forecast, and now we're well above where we thought we would be even pre-pandemic. So where is all this, you know, strength coming from? The vast majority of it has to do with a really, really very bullish economic outlook, which, as you see now, is on the first chart that Josh has pulled up. This is gross domestic product growth, so output growth across the U.S. And, you know, I've really never seen such a strong outlook. And it's not just strong, but it's really a consensus across all economic forecasters that are somewhere in the range of good to great going forward. And as you see here, it's been several decades since Ronald Reagan Morning in America in 1984, since we've seen the kind of growth that the consensus right now expects. And so that's certainly something. A lot of it came from fiscal policy. You see in the bullet point there, we had about a 10% hole in the economy, 10% hole in GDP. And what did we fill that hole with? About 25% worth of GDP in terms of federal aid and federal transfer programs. And so more than healed the damage, which is an experiment that we've never really seen before. So by all accounts, though, we're going to be looking, at least as we go in for the first year or so of the biennium, we're looking at an extremely strong economic situation. Obviously, a lot of things can happen in 2 years, but right now we're on a pretty strong footing. So like I say, we have the consensus is really somewhere ranging from good to great. The folks that are talking about more of a good rather than a great outcome are really pointing toward constraints on growth. Particularly, it's very hard to find workers right now, and we have supply bottlenecks in terms of trying to produce as much as we'd like. Things like the chips in automobiles or lithium for the batteries and the like, which are kind of holding back some of our growth today.
Mr. McMullen, we have a question already. Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. McMullen, in this strong growth ahead, GDP growth ahead, do you take into consideration possible tax increases that might happen at the federal level? Or is this a forecast that just says, if all things remain the same, this is what we see? Thank you.
Absolutely, Representative Reschke, Chair Nathanson. Yeah, we do try to incorporate tax changes at the federal level. It's a different method than we use for state law. It's an important distinction because in terms of any state tax changes, we have a current law forecast as our methodology, which means we don't put it in the forecast, no matter how likely it is, until, you know, the governor signs it and it's an actual law. So we're not putting words in the mouth of policymakers. In the federal level, it's a little bit harder because for part of our macroeconomic forecast, we depend on advisors and vendors from 3,000 miles away who incorporate some of this, to what extent the federal tax policies change the economic growth trajectory. So a little bit's in there. Some of it, like I say, is indirect through the vendors, and some of it is added on by our advisors. Say, oh, you need to, you know, bump the, you know, this impact up or less. So that's in there. But where it really, really impacts is more once we get down to the revenue forecast, because what the tax law changes do is they really change taxpayer behavior. And we are anecdotally seeing a lot of that today in anticipation of some of the federal tax law changes to come. In particular, some of our advisory groups in terms of our tax professionals do anecdotally say that they are doing what they can to, and particularly did during the last session for some clients, to try to pull income, realizations of capital gains or business income or the like, into 2020 before any of these tax increases, particularly a potential capital gains tax increase, comes to light. And so we do have some of that in here, where we have shifted forward some of these non-wage type of income as a behavioral response to these taxes. But I'll talk a little bit about more later, but this can be a really big dynamic in terms of tax payments.
Thank you, Mr. McMullen, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Sorry, I apologize. And so this is unequivocally good news, given that we're talking about very strong growth rates. Economic growth is not a bad thing, but it certainly makes for a challenging forecast environment in Oregon, particularly given our unique kicker law. So unlike other states, you know, here we are more than two years out from the end of this next biennium, and we have to come within 2% of the amount that comes in. And so when we're talking about this booming economy, that can be a scary thing, because we really have to stick our necks out with an aggressive forecast, or we're risk giving away the mother of all kickers. And so we're in this position right now, and part of the growth in this outlook is to make sure that we're trying to cover from what this sort of strong economic growth would imply for our revenues. And so along the way, between here and 2 years from now, a lot can go wrong. So, you know, while this is, you know, obviously good news for budget writers, I really employ them to that, you know, savings going forward is a must. So with that, I'll go ahead and pass it along to Josh, who's going to talk about some of the reasons why we have such a bullish outlook.
Thanks, Mark. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Josh Lehner with the Office of Economic Analysis. And the primary reason why the overall economic outlook is so bright has to do with that federal policy Mark was talking about. In particular, the income support to households and to firms has been unprecedented, and certainly unprecedented outside of wartime. This chart shows you income in Oregon and how that has changed over the recent decades when it comes to different business cycles. You start at the left at zero. This is how much total income was in the state. So aggregated across all of the populations on average, we start at zero, and then you see how income evolves over the course of the cycle. And the red bar, the red line, is where we are today, right? We're at that second spike in the first quarter of this year when that additional recovery rebate, the extra $1,400 per person that went to about 95% of Oregonians qualified for it. And so income, as of recently, were 20% higher on average than they were at the start of the pandemic. This ultimately is the reason why the outlook is so bright. It has allowed households and it has allowed firms to keep their heads above water overall. It doesn't mean we haven't had some people fall through the cracks and some businesses have certainly closed, which we talked about, you know, bars and restaurants being down 5 or 6% last time we were with you guys as a group. Those patterns continue. But overall, we're not seeing a lot of lasting permanent damage, in large part due to this federal support. Encouragingly, if we were to take out the direct federal aid, underlying incomes in the economy are all the way back, right? So this cycle is different. The policy response has been different. The underlying dynamics are different. And as the pandemic continues to wane, we're expecting more like a 1980s or 1990s overall economic recovery and not a 2001, not a 2007 long-lasting demand-driven recession. This cycle is different than that in nature. Importantly for the outlook, while these incomes are up, we know consumer spending has not been as robust because a lot of things were restricted, either due to explicit health policies or because people were scared of the virus and they didn't go on vacations. They didn't get on the airplane in as large of numbers. They didn't spend as much going out to eat or getting their haircuts as they would have during a non-pandemic time. And so household savings has accumulated. As of March, it was about $2.3 trillion at the U.S. level. That's 15% of annual consumer spending is just sitting in bank accounts today, ready to be spent if people want to spend it or when they feel safe to spend it. And so that right there is the big reason for the strong outlook. And of course, as we shift out of physical goods and home remodeling and car sales and back into going out to eat and on vacations and the like, this is very pro jobs. These in-person consumer services are very labor intensive. And so a lot of these jobs that have been lost in the last year are expected to come back relatively quickly, because the income and the spending is there to support strong job growth in the months ahead. If we put that together with our overall employment outlook.
Excuse me. We have a couple of questions already. So I'm going to start with the first one, and you don't have to answer it because it could be that this question is coming from others also. You mentioned jobs will be coming back. My question is going to be, can people return to the jobs that are being made available? So our first question after that is Representative Reschke, and that will be followed by Representative Valderrama.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Lehner. Previously, we've heard about a K-shape recovery where folks who were maybe white collar or could work from home were doing fine and recovering quickly. But those that worked in specific industries or maybe were lower income were going to have a tough time out of that. Is that still true, or is the K-shape no longer K-shaped?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, in terms of employment, very much is still K-shaped, right? The low-wage service workers still disproportionately have very few job opportunities relative to pre-pandemic, whereas those high-wage, white-collar occupations, in aggregate, if you add up all those types of jobs, they didn't lose jobs during the pandemic. They slowed down barely any growth last year, but they didn't lose jobs on net if we look at the latest data. So the K-shape in terms of employment, very much the case, and that will be what is kind of reversing as the economy continues to reopen. In terms of income, you know, we don't have great real income data across the spectrum, across the distribution, but given the federal policies in place with the enhanced unemployment insurance benefits, the recovery rebates, and the like, we know income certainly don't look like the job prospects do for a lot of the low-wage workers. We have seen, you know, indications of struggling renters have not increased that much. We, you know, personal bankruptcies have not increased and the like. So there's some indications that on a financial income side of things, we're not seeing quite the K-shaped recovery on the low end, that down leg. Now on the up end, the upward trajectory, that continues given where asset markets are and housing markets and home prices and the like. So the assets is more of a, I don't know, 45-degree line, not a K-shape per se.
Thank you, Mr. Lehner, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Valderrama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have a similar question. You know, I know that undocumented communities were left out initially of stimulus payments, and the kicker also is a good example of not everyone getting back the same amount. And I think we've also seen mothers leaving the workforce at disproportionate rates. And so I'm just curious if you can share a little bit more, if there's information around the racial and ethnic demographics of where these gains are specifically, either for individuals or MWSB businesses. And so just to kind of slightly reframe it, you know, it's great to hear that there's additional increase of resources, but who specifically has it been going to?
Yes, Chair Nathanson, Representative Valderrama. Right, there's certainly some disparities within the data. Again, as we talked with the revenue committees last month or the month before, when it came to available data, we do not have very good real-time economic data. The sample sizes for the employment reports and things like that are just not large enough at a federal level to really get good racial and ethnic disparity data. That said, when we do dig into it, from an economic perspective, from a jobs perspective, it seems like different racial and ethnic groups have suffered proportionately in terms of job losses and recovery to date. Doesn't mean that we have to wait. We have to wait for the good census data to confirm that. We have to wait for the good census data to talk about household incomes. But in terms of the employment information we do have, the COVID recession does not appear to have widened racial disparities, although they exist. We have a slide coming up on that, and we have some stuff in our report along those lines as well. In terms of the gender differences, there's no question that mothers have suffered employment losses disproportionately relative to fathers. In aggregate, there is not a men and women difference, but when we focus specifically on parents, there is a father-mother difference. That said, the something like the lack of in-person schooling is a tremendous microeconomic challenge for families. I don't know if anyone else on this call has young kids at home. I know some of us do. It is tremendously challenging to parent children for more than a year and teach them in school. And so at a micro level, it is a tremendous challenge. The data do not indicate that mothers, when you look at parents more broadly, we're not seeing parents disproportionately affected. We are seeing some of the mom versus dad discrepancies, but not the parents versus non-parents in the broader economy. So that's a little hard to parse. But it also makes intuitive sense given we know mothers maintain kinship and relationships and childbearing and household duties at much higher rates than dads do in our society. And with that, I'm going to move on to the employment forecast headline outlook, right? And this is the same sort of chart where we start at zero on the left. This is how many jobs we had in the economy prior to the recession hitting. As you drop down, this is the severity of the losses. As you work your way back up to the right, it's the recovery phase. As you hit zero and go above it, you're now at a historic all-time high for employment. And again, the red line looks different. This is not a normal, traditional recessionary cycle. We're expecting a lot of really strong growth in the next 6 months. We made this switch last time we met with you in the March forecast, where we're front loading the growth, given the income data, the consumer spending data, the fact that inventories are very, very lean across the economy and consumer demand is very strong. Underlying currents are in the economy for a very robust, very quick recovery in the months and quarters ahead. As such, that does mean some of the risk maybe lie more to the downside. Not only are we going to see very strong growth, we think we're going to see very strong growth in the immediate term. To the extent that we run into some supply constraints and some bottlenecks, and it's harder to find workers, so you can't hire and expand as fast of rate as you would like as a business, then maybe we will see a slower economic trajectory. And even if we're at the same point 5 years from now, the path through the upcoming 21-23 biennium matters tremendously for revenues, whereas this front-loaded growth, that really steep sector of the red line you can see there, if that's more of a traditional economic recovery, strong gains but slower than anticipated, that means revenues and wages and the like could come in below expectations next biennium, even as the overall trajectory of the economy is certainly up. And to talk more about some of these constraints in the economy, I'm going to switch it back over to Mark.
Thanks, Josh. So yeah, again, so the question is, you know, we have all this momentum, as Josh explained, all the forced savings and the federal aid and the like that are really pushing forward economic growth, but what could potentially choke it off? And what economists are talking about right now are supply constraints. To a certain extent, like I mentioned before, we have some of these production constraints, the, you know, chips in the cars, the lithium batteries, stuff like that. But the big one out there right now is talking about labor constraints, which is a little bit odd given that we are at somewhat, you know, elevated in terms of our unemployment rate, yet that's certainly not what employers are feeling out there in terms of the ease of finding workers, where the labor market is clearly very tight. We have job listings, you know, all the way back, and we're starting to see wage pressures as well as employers are forced to pay more to attract workers. And so there are a lot of factors behind this. As you see there, the Labor Department estimates that 45,000 Oregonians are not looking for work due to the virus. That could be a lot of different things. They could be, you know, afraid of the virus. They could not have childcare at home. It could be lucrative unemployment insurance and things like that. So there are a lot of things going on, but 45,000 is a big number. So to put that in perspective, that's a good year of job growth for Oregon. And so, you know, obviously bringing these folks back in does certainly gives us the capacity to expand quickly. And so here in terms of the chart, you're looking at the UI replacement rates, unemployment insurance replacement rates, which is obviously something that's very much in the discussion right now from a policy perspective. And so the dark blue line is taking the enhanced benefits and adding those to the regular program to show, well, what percentage of your base wages are getting replaced. And so right now we're in a position where the average worker, excluding tips and the like, this is just the base wage, but the average worker is getting about 100%. So basically getting their full wages replaced by the unemployment insurance program, which is, you know, relatively lucrative. Obviously, it's not going to last forever, but it is one factor that may be holding down labor supply at this time. I'm sorry, Chair Nathanson.
Yeah, I think you're on mute, Madam Chair.
Whoops. We have a question from Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you for your presentation. It's greatly appreciated. I think you just actually answered my question. I wanted to address what is going to stimulate folks who are on the sidelines, those 45,000 individuals, to come back to the workforce. Do you have any thoughts on what it would take to stimulate them to do that?
Yeah, and like I say, unfortunately, we don't get the breakdown in terms of these 40. I'm sorry, Representative Smith, Chair Nathanson. We don't get the breakdown. How many people are not looking because they're in an industry that's shut down? How many people are not working because they're afraid of getting sick? How many people are not working because they can't get childcare? How many people are not working because they'd rather make the same amount of money and sit at home, right? There's all that. We don't get that breakout, so it's hard to say, you know, what those relative differences are. From a broader perspective, even once, you know, this is only a couple months more before we lose this particular factor, the unemployment insurance. But from a broader perspective, I think it's important to note that as we go forward, tight labor markets are going to become the norm here in Oregon. You know, I said 40. I'm sorry.
And I appreciate that. I don't want to slow the conversation up. It's just, this is a major issue. I think collectively, colleagues, we need to focus on. In a little county of Morrow of 14,000 folks, there's over 350 jobs available today in a county of 14,000. So this is a real issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks. Yeah, and part of that's, part of that's because, you know, all of these hirings coming at once. So there is a little bit of a bottleneck where, you know, Deschutes County asking for 50 substitute teachers all in one day, that's not easy to fill. And so there's part of that. And what I was going down is as we go forward, the next challenge is going to be the aging workforce. We're at a point now, and it's clear that this is probably accelerating due to the pandemic, but we're getting about 25,000 a year in terms of retirements of the baby boom population cohort. So in terms of the tight labor market and trying to encourage workforce, that's going to be a longer term problem than just this one cycle.
We have another question, Representative Valderrama. Representative Valderrama and Representative Reschke, you had your hands up. Maybe your questions have been answered for the moment.
I'm going to pass my question so we can move forward, but thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I'm noting that we do have 21 slides to get through. Representative Marsh, you haven't asked a question yet.
Thank you so much, Chair Nathanson. And this may be a question that you are going to get to later in the presentation, so I'm happy to wait if it is. But I look at all this question around workers with the lens of Southern Oregon and where we have a tremendous housing shortage and a 1% vacancy rate. And I'm just wondering if you, we talk about many different issues in these revenue forecasts, which is part of why they're so interesting. I'm wondering if you have any comments now or later around the tremendous housing pressures that we're seeing and how they factor in here to the worker shortage.
Yeah, Representative Marsh, Chair Nathanson, you're absolutely right. Across the entire state, there's a shortage of housing, and in particular, the workforce housing, both in rural and urban areas. And so that's a big challenge. Over time, we just have not been building enough. It's a supply problem. So, you know, there are concerns now about, you know, how we're seeing a lot of price appreciation like we did back in, you know, the housing boom and all this. And then, oh, well, are we going to crash again? Well, no, because right now the problem is we just don't have enough places for everyone who wants to move here. And so that is certainly a challenge. Unfortunately, we do have 22 more slides. We didn't put that in this time, but in the report, we have three big pages full of the housing analysis. So I implore you to go ahead and take a look at the report. So we do have some fresh analysis there talking about it, because it is a very central issue.
Yeah, thank you.
So another one that a lot of folks are very interested in right now is the potential for inflation, not just the potential, but what we're seeing right now in the near term in terms of price increases. And there are clearly more to come. The inflation chart there is on the left, you see producer price index has taken a spike like it hasn't in about a decade. The outlook from our vendor is to bring that down, but it's probably likely that we're going to see increased price pressures throughout the medium term. It's really inevitable because we have a bottleneck going on right now, because, you know, we've had this economy ramp up so fast and we've had such a burst in demand that we're getting pricing pressure from a lot of different sources. First is the production costs, where we're seeing, you know, materials across the board, you know, lumber and metals and the like are up, you know, and energy and the like. And so we're seeing some, you know, push in terms of production costs. And further, we're also seeing, of course, a lot of demand with all of this money in consumers' hands and they're spending it. That's creating price pressure. If you go out today, it's going to be very hard to find a washing machine or an RV just because there's so much demand. Now, eventually, supply will catch up. People can still build washing machines and RVs, but it takes time. And so there's this a lot of temporary inflation, which is, you know, unavoidable at this point in time. The fear really is, to what extent does this become persistent or, you know, runaway inflation? And the broad consensus so far is that we're not there yet. The Federal Reserve says, well, we can't really have persistent inflation until we have a very, you know, tight labor market that's pushing wages up for a long time, that we're not at full employment, so that we can't really have that sort of long-term wage push inflation going on. But that's not the only way to get runaway inflation, and part of it has to do with policy, the exact monetary policy that the Federal Reserve itself does. And so there are people that, you know, more and more voices out there that are concerned that to the extent that we have this very, very accommodative monetary policy, very, very loose fiscal policy, that we're just printing money, and that's really a recipe for runaway inflation. And so the little picture there was to remind me, the story here really harkens back to when I was a little kid. I used to love the old Godzilla movies, and the plot of the original Godzilla movies was always pretty much the same, and it's very much like this inflation debate, insofar as in the Godzilla movies, you always had humankind was abusing Mother Nature and polluting and doing all sorts of horrible things, and eventually Mother Nature wakes up Godzilla to go and avenge the humans and bring things back into balance. And so during these movies, there's always the old timers who are wise and telling folks, hey, you know, you got to stop doing this or you're going to wake up Godzilla. And, you know, all the modern folks were, you know, Godzilla's dead. It's a myth. We're not worried about it. And eventually, next thing you know, Tokyo's rubble. So we're kind of in the same position now as economists with the like runaway inflation. So there are a lot of there right now, you know, there are voices coming out, a lot of them being the older economists who lived through the 70s and the early 80s, who are saying, well, you can't just print all this money without risking runaway inflation. But then we have the majority of folks saying, well, no, you know, inflation's kind of dead. What we really have to worry about is Japan-style deflation, given our demographics and the like, and we're really not in any danger going forward because of it. That's the real risk. Well, you know, at some point in time, if we print enough money out there, you know, we will wake up the runaway inflation, you know, and just like Godzilla, you know, Godzilla is either woken up or he's not. And so it's the same sort of thing with this runaway inflation. It's once it cracks people's beliefs and they believe that their dollar is going to be worth less tomorrow than it is today, well, then everything spirals down. Once everyone believes that they're just going to continue to print money and that we're in that world, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and we're there. But it's very much like a light switch. So I don't think we're there yet in terms of printing money, but I don't know what that point is when you wake up the runaway inflation and we get back into that world again. One final comment on inflation is surprisingly, it's not bad for everybody. One of them being us in our little world as revenue forecasters, because the tax collections aren't done on a inflation-adjusted or real basis. You know, the taxes we pay are nominal dollars, are regular old dollars out there. And so when we get inflation, we see more revenue come in. It's obviously an issue on the spending side of the budget, But in our little fiefdom, it's not. And it's not just business income and maybe wages that flow through the personal income tax. Nowadays, Oregon has really diversified our revenue base to such an extent that a lot of our instruments are going to benefit or grow faster due to inflation, right? And of course, the big one now would be our new commercial activity tax. But we've moved to a consumer base on a lot of fronts. We can, you know, when we buy a car now, it's a privilege or use tax. We have those. And we have all our sin taxes, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana. We have the lottery. We have lodging taxes. And you can go on and on now about how we've really extended and expanded our consumption exposure, which means more inflation, more money. And the other group that benefits from this would be folks who are in debt or borrowing money. And so if you're borrowing money at a fixed rate on your credit card or whatever it must be, your home equity loan or whatever, inflation makes that debt smaller and smaller and smaller in real time, in real terms over time. And so your borrowers do benefit from extra inflation.
Mr. McMullen, we have a question from Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be quick. As a former Godzilla fan as well, I didn't know there was an economic lesson in there, so thank you for that. This topic really concerns me, and can you quickly, in three sentences or less, say what happens to folks who are in the lower income strata when inflation hits?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, Chair Nathanson. It's hard for me to do anything in three sentences. I already wasted one. But at any rate, yes, it really does eat at lower incomes more than high incomes. You see the hamster wheel up at the top because you have to earn more and more in order to keep the same standard of living. Well, the issue with lower income households is they spend pretty much all of their income month to month, whereas high income households, you know, do save some of it and would benefit from higher rates that come with higher inflation. So it does disproportionately impact lower income households that do have such a higher propensity to spend. That was about 10 sentences. Sorry.
Very good. Thank you very much.
That was great. It illustrates the value of words as well as time.
Thank you. Okay, so if we're done with inflation, we're going to move on to a little bit of stuff I feel bad because we're doing, you know, in terms of our little world, the revenue world, all these numbers are up and all the averages are up and we're talking about, you know, the biggest growth in decades and all this stuff, but it's not like we didn't have this horrible shock to the economy and it's not like we haven't had damage done. And even in the best of worlds, in terms of, in which we may be in now, in terms of economic growth, we still have these really persistent disparities out there in terms of across income groups, low income, high income, across a rural, urban divide here in Oregon, and even in the best of times, and largely also in terms of racial and ethnic disparities. And so Josh is going to talk a little bit about some of those sticky racial and ethnic disparities that don't seem to go away even in the best of times.
That's right. So the chart on the left, we're looking at the prime working age population, generally defined as those 25 to 54 years old. These are the people that have the highest labor force participation rates and highest employment rates and the like. And what you see here, the way you read this chart, is all of these different racial and ethnic groups, Asian Oregonians, Hispanic or Latino Oregonians, Black Oregonians, American Indian, Alaska Native Oregonians are benchmarked relative to their white non-Hispanic peers. So if you're at zero, that means you're employment rate is the same as white non-Hispanic Oregonians. So if you're below that, it means you see lower employment rates within a given racial or ethnic group. If you're above it, you have higher rates of employment than the white non-Hispanic population. And so what you see over time is some of these large employment disparities are certainly persistent. They have shrunk a little bit over time. One of the benefits of a strong economy and a tight labor market is we do see all of the disparities Mark was talking about in terms of income, in terms of geographic, in terms of racial and ethnic, do tend to lessen in a strong economy, in part because employers can be less picky when it comes to filling job openings. If they want to hire, if they want to expand, they're going to hire people with an incomplete skill set, with maybe don't have all the qualifications, maybe they have a long gap of unemployment on their resume or the like, or maybe even previously incarcerated or something along those lines. All these barriers to employment tend to get less pertinent in strong economies. And so we saw, even in 2019, we saw the lowest poverty gap on record between white Oregonians and BIPOC Oregonians, right? But still, even in 2019, we had an unemployment rate that was 4% for white Oregonians and 12% for black Oregonians. We had a poverty rate that was 10% for white Oregonians, 25% for black Oregonian households. And so the disparities are large, the disparities persist throughout time, but they do tend to shrink in economic expansion. And they certainly, we saw some progress in the last economic expansion. But again, the tight labor market and even educational attainment, which is a key factor here, do not fully explain a lot of the disparities we see. And they certainly don't on the income front. So you control for educational attainment, you control for occupation or industry worked in, you control for work experience, and within firm tenure, how long you've been with the particular employer over time, you know, you control for all of those things. And these disparities do lessen in the data. However, they don't go away entirely. And you're still left with some unexplainable factor, and unexplainable mean you can't control it with standard economic measures. And you're still left with disparities. And generally speaking, sociologists and economists will chalk up that unexplainable portion to some level of discrimination, outright discrimination or implicit discrimination within the economy. The other thing that's going on, I alluded to this a second ago, is the chart on the right. We're going to focus on prime working age men in Oregon only, just to simplify the discussion. They're sort of top to bottom by employment rate, the dark blue bar, right? With Asian and Hispanic and white Oregonians having the highest employment rates. As you go further down the list, and American Indian, Alaska Native in particular, and black Oregonians, you'll notice that not only are the employment rates a little lower and the unemployment rates a little higher, focus on the right-hand side, not in the labor force due to being in group quarters. Most of this is what's called institutional group quarters, which really means prisons. It includes mental institution, it includes military barracks, it includes dorms and the like, but that is a very, very small slice of the population. We're looking at incarceration rates for some of our communities of color, you know, that are at least four times that what it is for our white non-Hispanic peers. This incarceration issue in particular accounts for 26% of the black white employment gap, and it accounts for 50-60% of the Alaskan, Alaska Native American Indian white employment gap within the data. So some of these issues are certainly much larger and societal in nature and policy driven than just underlying employment trends in the broader economy, because larger swath of some of our communities are not participating in the labor force due to some of these other reasons. We have a chapter on our three main types of disparities our office tracks on a regular basis: the geographic, the income, and the racial and ethnic in our document, if you're interested in reading some more on these.
Mr. Lehner, we have a question from Representative Valderrama.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate this slide and the additional context. It's very helpful. I'm curious if you can share a little bit about some of the data on women. We talked a little bit about that earlier, and especially working mothers. And I, you know, can attest, I'm one of those single mothers who left the workforce predominantly because I needed to keep food on the table, and I have a young daughter, and also am in a intergenerational household where I support my mother. And I am just curious where that information is. Perhaps it's later in the report or elsewhere, if you can share kind of the trend in working mothers as well.
Representative and Chair Nathanson, absolutely. We're happy to share that, have all that information. We cut a chart out of the document along these lines because it just didn't look quite right. Mark and I were chatting about it a couple hours ago. But I do have all the downloaded census data where we can produce charts just like this for those with college degrees, those without college degrees, for men versus women, and by racial and ethnicity. And so happy to make sure we share that with you offline or next week.
Thank you. And there is a question from Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a similar question about just about the differential impacts on women, because we know that, I mean, you mentioned earlier the data on childcare and the lack of, I mean, we already were in a childcare crisis before the pandemic. Women were already having to leave work because of the lack of a strong childcare infrastructure in this country. So I guess I just wanted to underline and emphasize the need to really look at the impacts on full employment for women, and it's particularly for Black, Indigenous, and women of color to see what the differential impacts are. And I'm curious if you have any insight into some of the just the additional investments that could be made to build up childcare availability so women and, well, all people, but particularly women can return to work.
Yes, Representative Pham, Chair Nathanson. I think you highlighted the thing that we see in the data. When it comes to struggling renters, and when it comes to working parents and moms in particular, we see these historical issues are historical in nature. The pandemic, to be honest, the pandemic does not look to have widened these disparities in and of themselves, the pandemic by itself. Now, but I think the pandemic has brought to light the fact that, you know, the poverty rate for rental households was 22%. In 2019, the strongest economy we've seen in decades, the poverty rate was 22%. So when the surveys show one in five rental households are worried about making next month's rent, it's like, that makes perfect sense because we know poverty rate is that high. Same thing with the childcare, right? Oregon's been a childcare desert for a really long time. Childcare has been really expensive and hard to find, which has made families, compensate in different ways, and intergenerational households even more so on dealing with elder care and the cost of that at the same time. And so we've made all of these life choices based upon the situations we find ourselves in, but the pandemic itself does not seem to have really exacerbated them is what the data tends to show. So where we're looking for investments, what are some of these issues that we can work on improving for our neighbors? Certainly everything you mentioned is top of the list.
Follow up, Ms. Nathanson. I'll just clarify. I just want to reflect back to make sure I heard what Mr. Lehner was saying.
If it's very brief, we're on slide 7, and we've got a whole lot more. I'm just trying to keep an eye on the time here.
Okay. What I'm hearing, Mr. Lehner, is that things were so bad before, and that women were already being impacted by the lack of childcare and having to leave the workforce, that it doesn't necessarily show up in the data, but that doesn't mean that it's not a serious problem that we have to address. Okay. Thank you.
Correct. Thank you. And okay, so we'll make up a little time. The next slide is really something, don't want to spend a lot of time on this. That's really kind of phenomenal. You know, this cycle is different. The way you read these charts is we're looking at our current forecast in red relative to the pre-pandemic baseline at zero. So this is the forecast we had, you know, March of 2020, which released it to you all in February of 2020. That baseline, even though it's zero and it's flat, there was growth in that, right? The trajectory was still up. The economy was improving. And so we're benchmarking our current forecast relative to that. And what it shows, what this chart is designed to show, is there's no long-run damage associated with the COVID pandemic, right? That the employment nearly gets almost all the way back. The income on the right gets, you know, it's higher today due to the federal policies, but then it drops down and it's at zero. So there's no long-run permanent damage associated with the pandemic and the recession, which is unique. Compare that with the gray lines below it, where we lost 5 to 10% of our employment, or what we thought would be our long-term employment growth. We lost 5 to 10% of that each of the previous two recessions. We lost 10% of our income relative to pre-recession expectations each of our last recessions, where we've seen these massive downgrades to the overall long-run economic outlook following the dot-com bust and following the Great Recession and housing bubble. Well, we're not seeing that today. The forecast is fully expected to regain all of the lost territory with no real permanent macroeconomic damage, at least in total. So that's pretty unique. We haven't seen this in quite some time, and that feeds through directly into some of the revenue numbers that Mark's gonna talk about next.
So I should be able to accelerate this through the slides here in the revenue outlook relative to the economic ones, which are a little bit denser. So this is May of an odd numbered year. So while we come in front of this group every quarter, this is the big one every 2 years when they let us out of the basement and we do our show here. Insofar as the legislature's in session, and so this particular May forecast is going to set the bar not only for the next biennial budget, but also for our unique kicker law 2 years out. And so this is the one where we really obsess on it more than anything else. And to start, the recent performance has been dramatic. The first chart shows personal income tax withholdings. So this is the stuff that comes right out of your paycheck. Typically, most of this is just wages. Some of it's coming out of retirement income as well, but it's really driven by the job market. But it's absolutely crazy. Here we are today, and Josh showed in his Outlook slide that we have 7% fewer jobs than we had going into the recession, but yet here we are, double-digit growth in tax withholdings. And once it's smooth, you see where the unsmooth data is literally off the chart here. So this is a big deal, particularly 2 years out, because if we get this wage picture wrong, boy, it really adds up over time. So if we're just 5% off of this withholding piece of personal income taxes, and somehow magically we were able to get the whole rest of the revenue forecast correct, by the end of the next biennium, we'd have a $1 billion kicker just because of this big engine here. And so this is doing a lot of the work and the heavy lifting going forward because we have such a bullish outlook in terms of job and wage gains. The next chart gets into an issue I wanted to highlight, which makes this May different than other Mays. Like I say, May is very, very important. Unfortunately, we don't have as much information as we normally do in a May. This year, the federal government extended the tax filing deadline until this last Monday. 2 days ago was the filing deadline. And as you see here, the left-hand chart would be the year-end payments. And in a typical year, once you get around April 15th, those things really ramp up as the DOR is quickly getting through the pile of returns. And at some point, they get through those returns, and then that flattens out. So normally, when we'd be in front of you at this point in the cycle, we'd already have that tax season winding down, whereas right now we're still right in the middle of it. So it creates quite a bit of uncertainty about where we're going to land. Less on the refund side. People who are expecting tax refunds tend to file sooner than people who have to pay money. That makes some sense, but nevertheless, there's quite a bit of uncertainty there as well. And so the reason we're highlighting this uncertainty, in turn, it's going to be a good tax year any way it lands, but is because it makes for issues in terms of closing out the biennium. In for one, you know, here in 6 weeks, we'll be at the end of the biennium. We have to run a balanced budget, but normally we would pretty much know where we're going to be in 6 weeks at this point. Right now, there's still quite a bit, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of uncertainty. So that really speaks towards keeping a nice, robust ending balance for the current biennium, just to ensure against this risk. I think it's likely we'll be over as under, but there's quite a bit of a range here. And the other issue is when we, in the fall, we come in and certify the kicker. Normally that certification is pretty close to what we told you all in May, but this time there may be, it may diverge from what we present today. But at any rate, it's been a solid personal income tax season, and it's been more than solid for corporate taxes, which is really, really remarkable. We thought that, you know, the corporate taxes over the years, we've, you know, there's downward pressure and fewer people or businesses are becoming C corps. We have the corporate activity tax that now people can write off against the C corps and the like, and profits have been, you know, as a share of GDP, you know, up at their, you know, at the high point, you know, really overvalued, but nevertheless, To date, nothing at all. And here again, this last few months, we've seen yet another jump up in corporate income tax. So the left is our running rate. So you see, we're getting near double what we were just a couple of years ago in terms of corporate excise taxes. And so this is really different, and certainly different on the right, as we see relative to other recessions. The last two recessions that dropped in half our corporate receipts. And so obviously going forward, this is an issue. We have a very modest forecast expecting that some of this will come down, that profitability won't maintain as firms hire more people and are forced to pay higher wages and have to incur some of the costs that they've been avoiding in terms of office space and business travel and the like. We have some downward pressure on this, but nevertheless, this has really resulted in quite a bit of growth. One quick note on our brand new corporate activity tax. I know there are some fixes going through these your committees to talk about it, and I just wanted to make one observation about the corporate activity tax. In general, they're on track for spending. In fact, we've bumped up the outlook, given what we've seen come in collections, by $60 million-ish for the current biennium, which is a good thing. But unfortunately, a lot of the firms haven't filed yet. We knew it was going to be a while before we had any information about the details of the tax program until we got tax returns. But we thought, since they were due in April, that we'd at least have them now and be processing them. But very few, we're looking, just a handful of firms are actually turned in their returns, even though it looks like compliance in terms of payments is going on. The firms are complying, but they're not putting in returns. And I know one of the things you're looking at are fiscal years. And I think, well, maybe that has to do, some of the big firms, you have an accountant out in Delaware or New Jersey, for one, maybe they're just not aware of the date. It's a new program. It's just one state. So maybe some of this is going on. Another thing that's been suggested by some of our accountants, advisors, is that, it's a very costly undertaking to run all the books. And since we have a fiscal years that don't necessarily match up with April, we're not going to do that twice a year, even if there are penalties to late filing. We're only going to run these books once a year when it's the end of our fiscal year, and then we'll go ahead and maybe file late or file early going forward. And so that's just an observation, and I don't know if those my theories are correct at all, but just something to highlight the policy discussion you're going through now.
Mr. McMullen, I'll ask a question now. Just as I'm thinking about, there's often speculation when you see early returns for voting. Well, who tends to vote early? And if you're only looking at those votes, is that a good indicator or not of what the outcome's going to be? What about tax filing? When we're talking about corporate tax, who tends to file earlier first? Is it a good indicator, or it really is just part of all that uncertainty?
Chair Nathanson, it's unclear with corporations. As I mentioned earlier, with personal income taxes, it's clear. Folks that expect a refund, they are in a hurry to file. Folks that expect to pay are going to wait till the 15th. They're darn well close to it. That makes a lot of sense. With corporations, we don't quite see it. And particularly with this CAT collections, as low as returns are, most of those people that have actually filed returns are paying taxes. And the amount of refunds so far are minuscule in terms of what we put out, in terms of get a return, kickback, overpayments in terms of refunds. Those are minuscule, but I don't have a theory as to why. But in general, I think, corporations, particularly for their one of 50 states, I don't know if they're really swayed in their timing so much about the cash flow issues.
Thank you.
Sorry, so moving on. Josh, I'm sorry, lottery.
Real quick, the lottery forecast has been raised. Normally, we take our economic forecast and we use that to inform what we think consumer spending will be on gaming in lottery in particular. This time, we've kind of used some of the strong gaming numbers to inform our macroeconomic forecast. In the sense, you can see this chart shows you the run rate of video lottery sales. The light blue is the pre-pandemic forecast. The dark blue is the current one. For the last 9 or 10 weeks, we've seen the largest 9 or 2 individual weeks of video lottery sales Oregon has ever seen. We set records by 20 or 30%, and it's been coming down. It's a normal seasonal pattern where we see higher sales in the springtime, and so we're coming off of that. The question is how quickly and how far, and do we think there's a long run outlook raise? And the answer there, at least what we have in the forecast today, is no. We think the sales will continue to taper. And because our economic and our income and our jobs forecast and our population forecast are all roughly the same as what they were pre-COVID, we think video lottery sales forecast will be the same as we thought it would be pre-COVID by and large. That does mean the forecast has been raised. We had some weakness in it before, but we're now expecting roughly the same one. But the good news here in terms of informing the overall economic outlook is we were worried that consumers would be hesitant. We knew they had the incomes. We knew they had the savings. We were wondering whether or not people would be scared to go back out and do indoor activities, given the pandemic is not officially over yet. The answer seems to be unequivocally no. People are willing to venture back out. Pent-up demand is real, and that's one of the reasons why we have such a strong overall economic outlook, in part informed by the fact that video lottery players, we don't think the player base has grown so much. We think we're just seeing higher levels of sales because incomes are up again above given the existing player base overall. That was all I had prepared for lottery. I see a couple questions.
Thank you. Representative Levy, please.
It's taken me this whole time to figure out how to raise my hand, so I apologize. Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Mr. McMullen, you know, am I the only one that's disturbed that the video lottery sales have leveled off and they're staying so good? Because recently I was eating in our local Sherry's restaurant, and for some reason all the video lottery was down in our community. And at least 3 couples who looked like they really couldn't afford to be doing lottery sales walked in and wanted to find out if video lottery worked in Sherry's, because they'd been to 2 other places and it didn't work. And they left, and they really looked like they couldn't afford it. So that really bothers me that, you know, in that space of time that I was sitting there eating, 3 couples came in. I mean, do you know the demographics of the people that are spending their money on video lottery sales?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Levy, Chair Nathanson. The lottery does put out reports. They're about to do a new one. The last one, in terms of their player base, is a little bit stale, where they go out and get consultants to do this analysis. In terms of the reports, it shows that if you just look at it, there isn't so much disparity in terms of, if you look at anyone who just says, I play the lottery sometimes, that covers a big broad picture of our population. The issue are, you know, intense users, and, you know, and the real heavy players, and that, you know, a very small number of players, you know, account for an outsized amount of the overall revenue. And so that can certainly be an issue in terms of the well-being of folks. And I think that and leadership has brought up to me many times that this, you know, obviously is not a positive thing. That said, with any hope, this huge spike that we're seeing right now isn't indicative of folks, you know, burning their last dollar and necessarily using all of their stimulus checks. The hope is that some of this reflects the fact that there are fewer other options out there. You can't go to a Trailblazer game right now, and maybe not on vacation. And, you know, and so there are fewer entertainment options. And hopefully some of this run up isn't, you know, a result of addiction, but rather, you know, more people just not having as many outlets to spend their money.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Nathanson.
Sure.
And I would just follow up real quick on that. You know, the latest research I have seen, which is a little stale too, it's a handful of years old, seems to indicate that 1-3% of the population is a problem gambler. Maybe up to 7% of the population is prone to problem gambling, but is not currently having being a problem gambler as of today. About 16% of Oregonians play video lottery every single month. More like 25% play lottery occasionally. And so as a share of the overall player base, we know it is certainly present. And so, you know, increasing funding or increasing treatment for addictions, mental health disorders and the like is always something that has a very clear role for the public sector to play in. But exactly how that, you know, plays out and where those funds should be directed and the like, you know, is beyond the scope of our office. We're certainly looking at the sales side of things and not the societal discussion.
Thank you very much.
And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Mark.
Okay, so really quickly, this is what keeps us up at night, and particularly as we go into this next, like I say, a very aggressive, stick our necks out over this next biennium. We know that we're going to have a lot of economic growth, but what we don't know are a lot of these non-wage types of income. You saw what happened to corporate profits and that they can get cut in half. But the same sort of thing can happen with business income and investment forms of income. And this is the big one, realized capital gains, insofar as this makes an outsized impact on the revenue forecast, both in terms of its numbers and also because of tax rates, because, you know, higher income folks are the ones who cash in capital gains. And so the more of them, the higher the average tax rate is. And so we get kind of a double whammy when we increase the forecast for this sort of thing. So what's the issue? Well, we have all these asset markets, stock prices and corporate profits and business income are all, you know, unsustainably large, or at least much larger than they are with their historical averages relative to the size of the overall economy. And so we, you know, some sort of correction is coming. And so, but when we look at economic forecasters, in a world where we have a strong economy and everything's growing and things are healthy, they have to have continued gains in these sort of things. It only makes, to make a consistent model, you have to have, well, the profits and business income are increasing and stock prices are increasing as well. And so the way they you know, rectify this is to have, well, just those things grow a little slower than the underlying economy, and then the underlying economy will catch up gradually, and then everything will be hunky-dory. Well, unfortunately, that's not our experience, particularly here in Oregon, in an income tax state and the like. And what happens is these things evaporate overnight, and we blow a big hole in our budget. And this has happened in the last two recessions at the same time we got the job losses. And this time, just the opposite. We're still seeing all of these things in terms of the investment income, asset prices, profits, all still at or near their record highs, which again is a huge risk. Again, you know, going forward in terms of leaving some budgetary cushion into this next biennium would be great. Just this change here, as we've ramped it up since March, we were expecting some pullback even in our baseline before, and we're just not seeing it. But now, to be consistent with our vendors, we like to take the forecast from 3,000 miles away, keep it at arm's length. This one, you see a considerable gap. So a gap of that size there, we're looking at, you know, $500 million a biennium just to make that change in the forecast that you're seeing there. And part of it is behavioral. Representative Rushkey brought this up in his first question, and that 2020 spike here we expect this year, once we finish processing the returns, is that record level. Some of that has to do with some pull forward in trying to get ahead of these potential capital gains increases that might happen at the federal level. They anecdotally, they're still doing it now in 2021. It's unlikely that it'll matter in 2021. The federal policymakers have gotten wise to this. We had big swings in the mid-80s when capital gain rates were changed, and another big swing here this last decade when the Bush tax cuts expired, with folks realizing a bunch of gains in business income earlier to try to get ahead of that increase. And so now policymakers make their changes retroactive to 2021. So it's likely that it won't make a difference in terms of how much people pay, but there's still going to probably be some pulling and back and forth. And so that's another sense of uncertainty, because obviously it's hard to measure that. And so there's a little bit of an add to this behavioral response, but we know it's out there. Longer term, there's a positive here in terms of Washington just enacted capital gains tax in their state. And this is something that a lot of people have worried about over time, that particularly people who are retiring, getting ready to sell their business that they've run for their lifetime, you know, there may be a big incentive to move across the border before you cash in. And this is something that has gone on for time. Now that differential has certainly lessened with Washington moving in their own. But this is the one that scares us, like I say, keeps us up at night. And, you know, we believe that, you know, it's tough to really justify, as you see in the past, you know, where we see these big drop-offs. We know we're going to have a stock market crash at some point. The problem is timing in terms of the forecast. To say that happens, you know, in March of 2022 or whatever is a very tough call to make. So, finally, moving on to the bottom line summary of what's going on with the revenues, and like I say, it's a big increase this time. To give some nature of it, you see, first of all, the income on the right. This is total income coming off of the Oregon tax returns and our forecast therein. And so even in March, we had a little bit of a slowdown, nothing like a real recession in there. But now we're at the point where there's no hiccup whatsoever. As you see, full speed ahead, up and to the right, here we go, which is obviously scary because of our history. It's hard to find. We do have one 20-year period where we didn't really have a revenue event. That would be from the recessions in the 1980s up into the 01. We had about 20 years. So it is possible, but it's unlikely. But on the left there, you see the issue with our office's forecast. This is a little bit, showing the dirty laundry. But basically, a lot of times we're shooting for the middle in a lot of ways in terms of coming up with the most reasonable outlook. And so you see there over our 40-year history, the different biennia, they really fall into two categories. When the economy is growing, it's expanding, we underestimate revenues. They end up coming in faster than we think, usually more than 2% faster, which means a kicker. But once or twice, we've gotten lucky where it's been a modest growth and really hit our forecast. The economy hits our forecast rather than the forecast hitting the economy, so to speak. In the other side, when we predict too much revenue, has only happened during recessions. So up until this last biennium, this current biennium, we've been in one of two pots. Either the economy is growing and we're not predicting enough revenue, or the economy is shrinking and we're predicting too much revenue and there's a budget hole. This last one was a new lesson. We thought, obviously, in light of this, looking at this, you know, record, it obviously informs our decisions. Again, we're really trying to stick our neck out now, because when the economy is expanding, we never put in enough growth. And in particular, this one, we're expecting an expansion like almost no other. And so it's particularly scary. Maybe given that we have stuck our neck out, we'll put one in the overshoot column for an expansion. This might be the first time this biennium, if, like I say, the stock market crashes or something along those lines. The undershot, we finally did undershoot this one, where when we did see the COVID recession hit, we knew it. We saw these catastrophic job losses, and we put a catastrophic recession in the forecast that did not come to pass. And so that's really the nature of the game. And although it's, like I said, not really flattering for us, it just tried to give you a little bit of insight on, why we're trying to be so aggressive this time to try to get rid of this historic bias that we've had. Bias isn't the right word. That's a statistical word. But I'm going to move on to Josh to talk about the forecast errors over time and the size of the current kicker.
That's right. We're unbiased in the sense that, generally speaking, the errors even out over the long run. Even, of course, they can be quite large on any given biennium. You can see here the 40-year history of our office, where we see the red line is the kicker threshold, the 2%. So when revenues come in more than 2% above our forecast made two and a half years previously, the entire amount is kicked back to taxpayers. Right now, we're at the light blue bar, our current forecast. We're estimating that we're on the order of magnitude of about 9.9% above the close of session forecast we made 2 years ago. That results in a $1.4 billion personal income tax kicker that will be given out as credits on the tax returns when Oregonians file next April. And also a $664 million corporate tax kicker, which the voters have now said that that is retained and dedicated to education spending and is not kicked back to corporate taxpayers. But the calculation is still made and therefore goes into the budgetary process. And so that is the current state of the land. This is two biennium in a row that we've given. We've undershot revenues noticeably during an economic expansion, as Mark was talking about, and keeping in pace with this process every 2 years when we do have a kicker. We have updated what we call is what is your cut of the kicker. The important thing here to note is this 1.4.
Mr. Lehner, excuse me, before we get to that specific slide, could you back up? Representative Pham has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I had a question. I know a lot of other states are also seeing more rosy revenue forecasts, but they don't have a kicker like we do in Oregon. I was just wondering if you could talk about, and I think it might relate to this next slide too, can you talk about the kinds of programs that we see in other states? Like I've seen in California and other states who are also seeing kind of an unexpected revenue surplus. What kinds of programs are they investing in that we could also be investing in if we reformed our kicker, for example?
Representative Pham, Chair Nathanson, in terms of the spending side of things, that is certainly outside the purview of our office, and it is up to the legislative process to determine that. But I think I assume that we could come up with a list, or NCSL could come up with a list of some of the things people are doing with these. And some of them are largely thought of as a kind of a one-time windfall. Certainly the ARPA money coming in is a one-time, not ongoing revenue stream. Now, in terms of the kicker process and the budget surpluses, we're not unique in this regard. As Mark led off with the first slide an hour ago, we had about a 10% hole in the economy, and we filled it with 25% of GDP worth of federal aid, right? So that has driven the underlying overall revenue and economic outlook so that it's higher today than we expected 2 years ago, because not only did we go through a severe recession, that hole was more than made up for in large part due to the federal policies, which then also continued to boost asset markets and capital gains and the like. And so some of the numbers coming out of California are roughly in line with what we're seeing here once you adjust for the relative sizes of our economy and population and the like. So we're not unique here. But what does make us unique is when revenues come in above expectations, Oregon policymakers do not get to keep that additional revenue.
Thank you. And it looks like something that we can save as a question for pretty soon after this, Representative Pham, asking NCSL to help us help us with a list of investments that other states are making.
Thank you. So the important thing about the kicker is that it is paid out the same way it is paid, the taxes are paid in, right? So it gives an equal share of a rebate to every single taxpayer. And so therefore lower income taxpayers get the same percentage back in the kicker as do higher income taxes. Now that doesn't mean it's equal in dollar terms, it's equal in percentage terms. And so you can see here, roughly speaking, this is an estimate of what the kicker will look like for different households at different points along the income distribution next year when they file their return. So we're talking about very low numbers for low income taxpayers, and then larger, 4 or 5 digit kicker credits for some of the higher income households. Now, in terms of, we've been asked before, you know, what does this do for the economy? We're returning $1.4 billion to taxpayers in the form of a larger refund or a smaller final payment next year. Shouldn't there be some sort of associated economic boost and increase in consumer spending? And undoubtedly there is. But the direct economic impact is muted to a certain degree because of how the money is paid back out, right? Mark talked earlier about some of our low income neighbors and friends. You know, they live paycheck to paycheck, they spend all of their money. And so if we were to give a larger dollar amount to lower income households, then we know that money would be spent. Higher income households have a higher savings rate, a higher propensity to save. And so therefore they're not going to go out and spend it immediately next spring when they file their tax return. So there's maybe a little bit less of a bang for your buck in terms of direct consumer spending next year when this kicker will be paid out. But overall, we know it will be spent or go to paying down debt or improve balance sheets among households and the like.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to just create a little pause here because I know many of people who are watching in the audience might be just needing some time to kind of process the numbers. And I just want to express my frustration at this slide. I thank you for making it so clear, but it is in the midst of this, still we're living in a crisis where even though the top wealthiest Oregonians and corporations are doing fine, clearly they're able to get income and that powers our revenue system, but that the Oregonian households that are suffering the most are getting $25 back or $149 back, while the wealthiest top 1% get back $12,000 is just so unequal, so inequitable. And I hope that I just want to express that I think many people watching this will express surprise and frustration at the inequities of our kicker system.
That's right. So moving on with the last bit of our time. And yeah, in terms of those inequities, there have been a lot of legislative concepts in my time here in terms of means testing it or capping it at a certain level for high income households, which have got quite a bit of support. Of course, the kicker is in the Constitution, so it's a bit of a heavier lift in terms of getting the votes. So here's the big story. The bottom line are the revenue changes. So these are the deltas from 3 months ago. So it's not the amount of increase over the biennium, but rather how much our forecast has changed relative to 3 months ago. And you see across the board increased with the biggest drivers coming from personal and corporate income taxes, the big ones that we've talked about. A lot of our sales-related taxes are doing very well, too. You see there the lottery and the marijuana revenues in particular are doing very well as households have more money to spend. But adding it all up is the yellow at the bottom, and so those would be the additional resources available to policymakers, $1.2 billion this biennium, $1.2 or $3 billion next biennium, at $1.6 billion in 23-25. Then it goes down 1.1, 500, and then back down to trend as we go into the future biennia from here. Again, so this is a tremendous amount of resources to help our budget writers, but at the very end, would like to again make a plea out there for savings, which is our final chart, but I will take the question I see there, if that's okay.
Yes, indeed. Representative Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This slide prompted a slightly different question that I'm not sure if you have details on, but I'm curious about, given this increased revenue, if you can talk a little bit about how much of a difference there is in students enrolling in higher education or CTE programs, if it's a higher or similar rate.
Yes, Representative Valderrama, I'm not familiar with the exact numbers. I do know that enrollments across our system are down, both in the, particularly in the community colleges and the like, but even in our larger colleges, we have enrollment down. There have been a big pushback this school year compared to, of course, last year in the pandemic, and people didn't want to pay for online schooling and the like. We have seen a return to applications at our major universities, but enrollment overall is still down, mostly across the board, particularly at the community colleges and the like. So our big universities are seeing people come back. And in terms of the training programs, I'm not too familiar with that, but I do know that that is something that the governor and her staff are looking to do with some of these resources, is to beef up some of those some of the training and workforce development programs. As we always end on our reserve fund slide, which is the good news that we have reserves that Oregon historically has never had until we put in some of these automatic deposits out of the rainy day, into the rainy day fund, out of ending balances and corporate tax and the corporate minimum tax and the Education Stability Fund, which is funded out of some of the video lottery spending and the lottery spending that we've talked about before. And so this is the cure for all the uncertainty we're talking about in terms of, you know, the kicker law making us stick our necks out, and that there's some downside risk in the upcoming biennium. The way to fix that is to have some flush balances, and we still have reserves. Unfortunately, they're not quite as flush as they were, given that we tapped in the special session some of the Education Stability Fund. Now, that was a very fortuitous timing for that policy. I'm very happy that it was done insofar as we were getting up close to the statutory caps that we were going to hit here in a year or two for the Education Stability Fund. So now we're at least clear of those statutory caps on that. So that's a good thing, they are a little bit depleted, but are expected, if you know the outlook comes to pass, to continue to grow going forward. But this is really the medicine for all the uncertainty our exposure to income taxes and high income individuals and our kicker law and our revenue system, to the extent that it's volatile, that's not such a problem as long as we manage to that volatility and keep these reserves around. And so this is really encouraging compared to past recessions when we didn't have access to this as a state. So with that, I apologize, Chair Nathanson, for going over time yet again. I do appreciate you having us, and we're welcome for anyone who didn't get to answer a question. Please hit us up, and particularly if we don't follow up on an issue that we said we would, go ahead and ding us, please.
It's been, as always, a very good presentation. The information is always presented really well. We enjoy listening to you, and you can't leave just yet because we have at least one more question, and I'm going to invite other committee members who are in the room to see if they have any last questions or comments while you're still with us. So don't go away yet. Rep. Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and this will be my last question. Thank you all very much for the information. That's been very helpful. I just wanted to lift up, you know, I actually, in the Oregonian today, drafted an op-ed with Representative Nose on essential worker pay, just to reiterate the need for investing in essential workers now. And I think you can probably see a trend here, and at least my questions is a part of being a majority women legislator, that women and data on women and mothers are particularly important to me. In the slide before this, I'm curious about the budgetary risk. If you can share a little bit about the budgetary risk of having too big of an ending fund balance instead of investing these dollars into essential workers or women, and essentially what the risk of a prolonged loss in workforce could be, if you have any information on that.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Valderrama, Representative Nathanson. You make a good point that, you know, my desire, you know, where in the chair I'm in, you know, obviously we like insurance for all the volatility that's out there. And it's very nice, particularly in terms of, you know, able to keep our existing programs alive. It's nice to have these cushions when things drop so that we don't have to make, inefficient cuts and deep cuts. But the point you make is a good one. Insofar as, well, you have to balance that against the value of the spending today and the programs today. And we can argue that given the level of need, although we don't see it at the top line numbers here, but we do know there's need where, you know, households are falling through the cracks and we have businesses failing and the like, that it certainly may be worthwhile to expose ourselves to some risk in future biennia in order to patch those Band-Aids now, because to the extent that households do fall through the cracks and they become houseless or the like, it costs a lot more to pull them out of that situation than it would be to prevent them from going in. Same with businesses closing. They're never going to open up once they close again, but if you can keep them alive, you know, that speaks well for the future. So making that sort of balance is obviously not in our purview. That's, you know, policymakers trying to, you know, to do that, to do that calculation, but you're right. You know, if need is high enough, then the budgetary risk in the future becomes a secondary issue.
Thank you for the question and the response, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have kind of a comment after hearing all of this. I think, you know, we're kind of set up to easily overspend and make promises we can't keep right now. So in my mind, we need to be sober and thankful and not become drunk on this excess revenue. I mean, just a while back, as they mentioned, we were in a $1.6 billion deficit. So at this time, in my view, we don't need new taxes and we don't need to raid the kicker, but we should really focus that money on one-time expenditures and target them on infrastructure, getting kids back in school, business pandemic recovery, and wildfire relief.
Thank you for your comments. Are there any other members of the House or Senate committee who have a question you've been waiting to ask or a final brief comment before we adjourn for the day? I'll wait a minute for people to find the right button to raise a hand. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the presenters for this thorough presentation. It's I've been around long enough that I have a feeling of foreboding, which I think was kind of dispelled during the presentation, because there have been so many times when on the eve of a giant kicker, it seems like days later we plunged into recession. It has happened several times. It still makes me nervous. I see some of the differences that they've pointed out in this presentation, and I just hope it holds. But I wanted to thank you for your hospitality, having us as part of this presentation, and to thank Josh and Mark for their excellent presentation.
So glad you've been here with us for the meeting. Anything else? Mr. Alanak, any final comments before we adjourn?
Just one, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I just want to point out, and I had referenced this at the beginning, within the meeting materials in OLIS, there is another document called the Other Funds Revenue Forecast. It is also produced by OEA. We added it in there. It deals, most of the forecast presented today is the general fund revenue and lottery. The Other Funds deals with all other revenue sources within the state. A couple of examples that Mark and Josh included today are the corporate activity tax and marijuana. I would encourage people to read that report. It has a wealth of information as well. And then the full report that Mark and Josh mentioned for their forecast report, they referenced it a couple times for additional information, it's located on their website. I'll talk to them about whether or not it's worth adding a copy to this link so it's all in one place, but it is on their website. That's not in the meeting materials at the moment, but I'll talk to Mark offline about possibly adding it here for ease of access.
And there is a link to their office and their website on the LRO homepage.
Yes.
So if you go to Legislative Revenue Office, I think when I look at it, it's at the top right. Is that right?
I believe so.
Other links, and then you can quickly get to OEA. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, everybody, for being here, and especially to our presenters, Mr. McMullen and Mr. Lehner. We'll see you next time. We're adjourned.